Hi, I'm Lenny from Oakland, California. I tune in weekly to the Cycling Podcast for the hope of hearing a guest appearance from Chiro. Without Chiro, there is no Cycling Podcast.
Hi, this is Scott Grinsell from Seattle. I'm a delusional amateur cyclist and an aspirational podcaster. I receive your insights from the cloud of sound.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by sigmasport.co.uk, the UK's leading road cycling store. All of your favourite brands under one roof with expert advice, rapid shipping and competitive pricing. Online, in-store and mobile.
Hello, I'm Daniel Freeb, not Richard Moore. You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Lionel Burney is here with me. Lionel, where are we and where is Richard?
Well, we're in the National Theatre, which is one of our home venues here in London. Richard's at the Tour of the Basque Country. He's taken a week there to take in one of the... It's not really a hipster race, is it? But it's not as high profile, perhaps, as the Monument.
And who have we got standing in for Rich? Who's his body double?
Well, body double indeed. It's Rob Hatch from Eurosport. Hello, Rob.
Hello, how are we?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, you well?
I'm brilliant. Really good Tour of Flanders yesterday. Excited to be back and talking about it.
When are we going to find out the result of this race that you had? This wacky race that you had last week?
Oh, well, the Trainer Road Challenge.
In the Velodrome.
Yeah,
the Velodrome.
Well done, Daniel.
The Trainer Road Challenge is... I think that episode will be out this week. It's being worked on now. And the result of the race between myself, Rob and Richard Moore will be revealed.
And we have a new sponsor, don't we? sigmasport.co.uk, the home of road cycling. So welcome them as well this week. And Lionel, I think it's time for your weekly roundup, isn't it?
Indeed. Well, I'll rattle through this and then we'll get on to the main business of talking about the Tour of Flanders. Of course, the latest monument in the spring classic season, and both races were won by reigning world champions. So we had the sight of a double rainbow in the finish straight in Oudenaarde. Peter Sagan won the men's race, of course. We'll talk about that in depth coming up. And Lizzie Armitstead outsprinted Emma Johansson in a tense finish to the women's race. They got away on the Pattersberg and worked well together, but they were being closed down by a chase group in the finish straight, and it was the world champion that won it by half a wheel, making it 5 wins out of 5 for the Bowles-Dolmans team in the UCI World Tour. Armitstead will no doubt be having a little eye on what Marianne Vos is up to, because the Dutch woman won her first UCI-ranked race since September 2014 when she took the Pajot Hills Classic in Belgium last week. Only a 1.2 ranked race, but it is her first UCI ranking victory for, well, what's that now, 18 months. In the men's racing, Louis Westra won the 3 days of Depana, where there were also stage wins for Alexander Kristoff, Elia Viviani and Marcel Kittel. Meanwhile, in Brittany, in northern France, friend of the podcast Brian Cockard won the Route Adelie. You can buy a Brian Cockard t-shirt from the Cycling Podcast shop at thecyclingpodcast.com. Click on shop. Jon Izagirre won the Grand Prix Miguel Indurain in Navarra in Spain. There was another win for a friend of the podcast. Young Teo Gegenhardt took the Trofeo Piva in Italy. That's a very exciting victory for young Teo.
We're cleaning up, aren't we? Friends of the podcast are cleaning up. Who knows? Richard might have gone to the Tour of the Basque Country to ride it, win it.
Well, while we're mentioning friends of the podcast, must give a big shout out to Chris Broadbent and Darren Wanstall, who we first learned about last year at the Tour de France when they had their Where Are We Lionel banner, which they took up onto the Col de Glandon, I think it was, from memory. They've been taking it to Flanders in the past week or so. They took it to the Grand Prix E3 Harelbeke, and they also posted a picture of the banner with Dan Lloyd and outside the Tour of Flanders Museum. So thanks very much to Chris and Darren. Really appreciate that support. Hope you've been enjoying the races and the podcast.
So, Lionel, you're our go-to man for contextualisation. Where does this Tour of Flanders stand in the pantheon? 100th Tour of Flanders, of course. Was it a five-star, four AA rosettes, or I don't know how that scheme works? But
well, five cobblestones, maybe, or five bergs. I mean, as a classic race, it wasn't quite the huge showdown that we wanted, but it was made special by just the sheer power and brilliance of Peter Sagan's victory and the way he chose that moment. I mean, our photographer Simon Gill was on the Pattersberg yesterday and he managed to take a sequence of photos that really encapsulate the entire race in sort of four or five frames. Peter Sagan has got Sepp van Mark on his wheel as they're coming up that final climb. There's 13 kilometres still to go on the flatter roads. So this is the last opportunity to put some distance between himself and everybody else. And he turns on the gas, really, and Van Mark is pedalling squares almost immediately. You know, he's not able to keep his bike in a straight line, and that just shows the effort he was making to try and limit the gap that Sagan was able to open. And then behind that, Fabian Cancellara is launching a kind of race-winning move effort. It's just that he's coming from behind, and then that sets up the pursuit match between them on those dead concrete roads. I gather there was a tailwind, so that would have been playing into Sagan's hands a little bit, but he toyed with Cancellara, didn't he? I mean, I know we're looking at the time gaps on the screen, and we're, you know, analysing, is the gap coming down, is it going up? And really, in the context of those last few kilometres, those seconds, we don't know exactly how accurate that gap is. But Sagan measured that effort perfectly and just kept, he held Cancellara off a bit like a sort of boxer with a longer reach, yeah, didn't he?
I mean, I've likened him in the past to a big grizzly bear, and there was a kind of revenant quality that I'm sure you've seen, Lionel, the recent Oscar winning film The Revenant, and it reminded me very much of the bear in that, who actually unfortunately died in the end, so the kind of analogy doesn't really stack up.
No, it doesn't really work there, does it? Thankfully.
But it was I called it a mauling on Twitter. It wasn't just a win, was it? Because however Cancellara looked as though he might come back at a certain point, you know, Cancellara was also working with Van Mark. Sagan's superiority was very, very clear to me, no?
Yeah, there were moments when Van Mark came to the front, started to do his turn, and every time he did, the gap started to open up again. Van Mark trying to shake out the cramps, banging his legs, rubbing his thighs, whatever he was trying to do. And I think Cancellara realised at the end that if he was going to become the greatest rider in Ronde van Vlaanderen history and become the only man to win it four times on retirement, which, let's face it, was his dream at the start of the day and a lot of his fans' dream. We saw the Swiss flags on the Paterberg and people everywhere. He had to do it himself. He would have had to do it himself, and he rode most of that final 13-kilometre pursuit, if you like. But the basic maths were that Sagan put about 8 seconds into them between the top of the Paterberg and the finish line, even had time for a celebration. And yeah, it might not have been the best ding-dong battle in terms of the Bonen and Cancellara that I think everybody wanted for the final time at the Ronde van Vlaanderen. But in terms of drama, we don't like it, but it's part of the race. There were a lot of crashes, there were a lot of nervous moments early on, there were a lot of things that just filled the race with action from start to finish when we saw it on our screen, and it was a five-star afternoon, I thought.
Well, it was a very hard race. I think Sean Kelly mentioned in the Eurosport commentary how hard he thought it was, and it certainly looked that way from a long way out, you know, 120 kilometres, 100 kilometres to go. It was very, very fast. Etix Quickstep took responsibility for making it that hard that early, and then I think we were treated to a real a sort of masterclass in how a classic plays out, because it isn't full on for, you know, 3 hours. There are these little moments where it kind of ebbs and flows and it calms down a little bit, and they ride some of the climbs all across the road, and you can see the pace has been taken out, and it's just drawing the sting out of people's legs at strategic moments, using the hard climbs to go hard perhaps, and maybe not wasting effort on some of the easier climbs, but knowing that all of the time people are getting softened up. Sagan rode it in, I mean, he's so visible, isn't he, in the world champion's jersey, but never really put a foot wrong all afternoon, was always in the right place and took his moment brilliantly.
Yeah, and it really underlined something we said in the podcast last week about Etix Quickstep and lacking a finisher. And again, they sort of took ownership of the race very early. They made it very hard, but then they were really, well, when you don't have a clear leader, you don't have a big puncher, you start to look devoid of ideas and devoid of strength. And again, they were found wanting, and, you know, sort of panic stations now in that team because they haven't won anything. I mean, it's not the first time this has happened to them. I was just looking back, actually, over their previous classics campaigns, that there is a perception that they, you know, always manage to pick up one or two every spring. But really, 2010, they won absolutely nothing. 2011, only Gent-Wevelgem. 2013, nothing. And they've still got probably their best chance to come with Paris-Roubaix.
But they did try something, you know, to be fair to them. They worked very hard in that early phase.
They did, but, you know, again, I would sort of ask questions about the role that Tony Martin played. I mean, I think, as we said again last week, Tony Martin's been a bit of a revelation. I think he's probably surprised even Etix Quickstep with how good he's been. But they've used him as almost a battering ram early in races. And, you know, you said last week that he wouldn't be allowed to get away necessarily. I still think that he could have done more at the latter end of this race and other races earlier this spring. And, you know, I know I've spoken to people around the team and they're also slightly miffed at the way he's been deployed in some of these races this spring.
But the other thing is, you know, Tony Martin in Paris-Roubaix would be slightly different perhaps because, you know, the horsepower does, you know, gravitate to the front a little bit more easily. The roads of Flanders are so technical, so narrow, so tight. You do need to know the course almost like the back of your hand before you can become a factor on it. And it's not just a case of just being strong. It's a case of being strong and being able to read the roads. And I mean, we saw with the you know, the crash that ruled out Greg Van Avermaet and half of the BMC team, you know, they were using that opportunity to try and move up on a wide, straight, seemingly benign bit of road, but they are often the most dangerous parts of the race. And I think, you know, a lot of that, you know, that racecraft, that know-how of the roads gets a little bit lost in the kind of the debrief. And you know, Tony Martin is not up there with sort of even the likes of Vandenberg and Terpstra and Stibar in terms of knowing those races yet.
Where does he fit into that team? It's easy for us to sit here and say, yeah, Tony Martin, cracking rider, superb rider. He's got the ability to go and win one of these things, even though he's started racing them late. But do you suddenly say to Stijn Vandenberg, who's made a career out of this sort of one or two days a year where, okay, he gets his own slight chance to attack from distance, and if it doesn't work, then he works for the rest of the team. Do you say the likes of Bohn and Stibar, Terpstra, hang on, you're being bumped down in the pecking order today? It's not an easy decision to make because somebody has to do the work early on, surely.
I think also they have definitely suffered, and as we said again last week, Essex Quickstep have suffered from the lack of clarity in their hierarchy, and they're very much at the mercy of what feedback they're getting from the riders in every race. And, you know, Wilfried Peters, the direct sportif there, who we've criticised and the Belgian press has criticised heavily, not just this year but in previous years, he's really at the mercy of what his riders are telling him. And if you've got one rider saying, well, I'm very good, and I think Nicky Terpstra has felt good a couple of times in races earlier this spring and maybe not been given full freedom to lead the team. But, you know, Terpstra's saying he's good, Martin's saying he's good, Trentin's saying he's good, then who do you hang your hat on? And I think that's been a problem for them. And, you know, again, you talked about the imponderables, Lionel, and how difficult these races are to manage in the race. But, you know, Peter Sagan is someone who, whether he runs out of steam or not in the finales of races, which he has done consistently up until now, he's always there and he always manages to pick his way around the problems, the crashes, the obstacles. And I think that is one of his incredible strengths. And you know, ultimately, that is also why, you know, probably yesterday he did have the energy left. And it wasn't a vintage team performance from Tinkoff by any stretch of the imagination.
No, it wasn't. But to sort of paraphrase or quote Sean Kelly, you know, the Tour of Flanders sometimes does resemble a scene out of Ben-Hur with everyone sort of, you know, galloping as fast as they can down the road, particularly when you get those helicopter shots and you see just how spread out over the fields that the bunch is. And that's what struck me, is just, you know, the remarkable skill to be able to just be in that right position. Sagan's not alone in that, of course, but he wasn't doing it necessarily with four or five teammates and bodies around him. Even, you know, Cancellara had, it must have been Jesper Stuyven who was with him till pretty late.
Devolder was there as well. Devolder was emptying himself, wasn't he, in the last 30, 40 kilometres, helping Cancellara save the energy until the Quaremont and then the Paterberg when he came back towards the end. And yet it wasn't just Essex Quickstep who had bodies up the front. Let's think about Team Sky. I thought they rode a brilliant race tactically, to be honest. They had lots of different efforts. And if we remember back to where the winning move went, it was Michał Kwiatkowski that initiated it, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was almost a repeat of last week, wasn't it, with Kwiatkowski and Sagan together again. And what you're saying there, Daniel, about Sagan's, the way he rides, again, from a helicopter shot, just watching how close Sagan was to Kwiatkowski in front of him, almost like he's riding on top of his back wheel, you know, getting so much shelter when he's sitting in behind. And that's an innate skill that, you know, he has. He can, you know, obviously he can sense just the best way to save as much energy as possible. I mean, we have talked about how upright he rides and his knees are out a bit. He doesn't cut the most elegant hole in the wind, does he? But he must be saving a lot of energy just from the way he manoeuvres his bike through the race.
Again, so much of this is about avoiding injuries, avoiding crashes, avoiding disaster. And really, Peter Sagan's Classics campaign should have ended on Via Roma in Milan-San Remo. He should really have crashed behind Fernando Gaviria, and for probably 8 or 9 riders out of 10, it would have ended there. And his victory yesterday is also fruit of brilliant bike handling on Via Roma, you know, 2 weeks ago.
The wheelie he pulled just after the line, straight past our commentary box after 256 kilometres of racing. Time trialling away, or whatever you want to call it, the pursuit match, if you like, for the last 13 kilometres after the efforts on the Quadamont and the Paterberg. He was still pulling a wheelie away, dodging the photographers, dodging the motorbikes at the end. He was certainly, his senses hadn't taken leave of him anyway.
And then we have the sight of the two rainbow jerseys on the podium together, Lizzie Armitstead and Peter Sagan. I mean, the Tour of Flanders itself couldn't really hope for a more fitting celebration of the 100th edition than that.
No, I spoke to one of the organisers afterwards. He said in the TV compound everything was just dying down. The ticker tape had hit the ground. The champagne had been sprayed everywhere. He said, well, the only thing we could have asked for better was a Tom Boonen win. But we've had the rainbow jerseys up there. After all the problems we've had in the last few weeks and the worry about what might happen, the security and what have you, the very, very tragic incident of the week before, he said it's been a perfect day. We couldn't have wanted anything different. Two rainbow jerseys, 100th Tour of Flanders, and everybody enjoying themselves.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by sigmasport.co.uk, the UK's leading road cycling store. Use the code PODCAST10 at the checkout to receive £10 off your next order of £50 or more.
So Lionel, your verdict was that it wasn't a 5-star or a 5-cobblestone edition of Flanders, but I'd put it to you that the route that was introduced, the new route that we've had now since 2012, is actually kind of coming into its own. And you know, the reason I say that is that the Quaremont and the Paterberg, which is the finale now, they're so different, those two climbs, and they really suit completely different riders. And you got guys like Nicky Terpstra and Fabian Cancellara who look really at home on the Quaremont. It's not a particularly steep climb and tend to make up a lot of ground there. And then someone like Sagan, who really almost mountain biked up the Paterberg in a tiny, tiny gear, and that's what took him away in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it was a 4.5 cobblestone race. It was very absorbing, entertaining. A lot was going on, and it was in the balance until the end. And you want it to be decided on those final climbs, don't you? And that's what's happened. And you know, we have seen additions on the old course where quite a large group has come together at the finish, and it's been more of a sort of sprint. I'm thinking of Nick Noyens when he won, I think, 2010. Yeah, I mean, he pulled a flyer on a big group of favourites.
And we do get misty-eyed about absolutely everything in cycling, don't we?
We do. I mean, I think the thing that was interesting in the big race explainer that I put together last week, talking to Alexander Kristoff, who'd never ridden the old course, and so he has no experience of how the ebb and flow of that particular course affected the race, so he only knows this circuit, and of course he won it last year, and you know, so he's been hit with this. You know, this is the Tour of Flanders for him. For riders who are a bit more experienced, it's changed the character of the race. It changed the way, you know, they all know the course, of course, in the old days. They all go and recce the course. They all know exactly how it's going to be played out. But I think just learning that you've got the Quadamont 3 times, that in itself is 6.6 kilometres of going uphill. That's a lot of climbing compared to the old course where you'd only do the Quadamont once. And they all tend to be pretty short. You know, a kilometre long is a long climb in the Tour of Flanders.
Yeah, they call it the odd one out, don't they, around there? The old quarter hill, as it is, the older Quadamont, it's a longer climb, as you say. And there are certain riders, when you look at the stats, that have a bit of a weakness on it. Ed Nieuwsblad, the Belgian paper last week, were all week going on about Michał Kwiatkowski. He's got a weakness on the Quadamont, they said. He can't push up like the big, more powerful riders, but he's stronger on the Paterberg, where he actually had the in-race course record, 54 seconds, I think it was, on the Paterberg, produced the most number of watts for that almost minute. It turned out that it was the weakness for him, the Eau de Quaremont, because he was dropped there against Sagan. Talking about the old course, it's interesting that the distance from the top of the Paterberg to the finish in Oudenaarde now, it is more or less exactly the same as it was from the Bosberg to Medebeke, the old finish. So there's not that much change. We can get a bit dewy-eyed, misty-eyed about these things. And I think the big test is talking to the locals, the Flemish. They still love the race as much as they did before. Yes, it's different. And I think from a television point of view, from a very selfish point of view, I'd love to talk over people going over the Muir all the time, but unfortunately, logistically, it's just not possible. It would mean nothing in the race. It would mean a huge detour to take the race in that region. And after tweaking it, as we were talking about just then, a few times in the last few years, we seem to have found a formula that produces great racing. I mean, I can't remember the last boring Tour of Flanders, can you?
And it's a question of familiarity, really, isn't it? Often in professional sport, and you know, this week there's the US Masters in golf, and that's a classic example of something that everyone has grown very, very accustomed to watching year in, year out. They know exactly what the 13th hole, the 14th hole, the 15th hole looks like. And as soon as you change that, then people get upset. And I really feel that, you know, we were probably all guilty of this, that we threw up our arms and said this is disgraceful when the Muir was taken out and this new course came in. We didn't like the idea of a circuit, but there are some real advantages to the being circuit, certainly for people at the race and, you know, in the big hospitality tents next to the Quaremont. They get to see the race four times, is it?
And the women's race as well coming up.
They get to see the women's race. And, you know, we heard Mark Cavendish last week. We were talking about safety. It's also a lot safer, isn't it, in terms of, I'm not sure how many fixed cameras are used, but there's certainly scope to use fixed cameras there.
Well, we had fixed cameras yesterday on the Quaremont, the Paterberg and the Koppenberg, all set up the day before. Obviously, you still do have to move motorbikes in and around that, certainly with different races going on. And yesterday we had the dual TV coverage, let's not forget, as well. So we had more TV motorbikes on the race than probably ever before. But it can be marshalled better. The points, because the roads are completely closed off, all the police and the marshals know exactly where the motorbikes can come in and out of the course. A lot of exit and entry points that need to be marshalled, but can be marshalled because of that circuit style and the organisation. And as you say, for the fans, for the VIPs, whether you like it or not, they're a very, very important part of keeping the race economically stable. And for anybody who just wants to rock up, it's like pitching your towel on the sunbed at 5 a.m. in the morning, isn't it? And you get there early, you pitch your tent up, you get the beers and the frites in, and you're there all day, and you've got entertainment to keep you happy all day.
Very fond of our German listeners, Rob. There's no need for that.
So we'll talk about Peter Sagan's efforts, but I just wanted to mention the guys from the early breakaway. From all accounts, we didn't see all of the race. We will see all of Paris-Roubaix on Sunday. That's being broadcast from start to finish on Eurosport and in France from the off for the first time. We didn't see the very early stages of the Tour of Flanders, but I gather from reports that it was a real battle to get into that first move, and it took more than an hour for that breakaway to go clear.
Yeah, we commentated on the first half an hour actually for the organisers, and right from the gun there were attacks all the way. We were hoping in that first half an hour to show the people watching around the world that breakaway go. But unfortunately, it wasn't possible. They kept going. There was even time to stop in Hogeleder, a little town about 25 kilometres into the route, to pay respects to Dan Minkheer, who sadly died of a heart attack at Critérium International last week. Peter von Petegem stopped, got out the car, laid a wreath. The brake rode through there. I didn't say the brake, the peloton rode through there nice and slowly, paid their respects. But then the fight was on again, and the brake didn't go for almost 2 hours.
And that probably what accounts for it being so hard so early. And that's what makes the performances of particularly Emmanuel Aviti of Movistar and Dimitri Klaes of Wanty Groupe Gobert so impressive, because they finished 7th and 9th respectively, having been out in front all day and managing to hold on to the coattails of a pretty select group by the finish.
Yeah, Aviti's an experienced rider in Ronde van Vlaanderen, and we didn't obviously think of him as a favourite. He's never going to be a favourite, but he's a strong ruler. We've seen that in his road captain duty for Movistar. 11 previous Tour of Flanders. 3 times he hasn't finished, but the best before yesterday, when he got a top 10 from the breakaway, was a 54th place. So a superb result from the man who's actually from Navarra, which is Movistar's hometown. So it was a good response from the homeboy to a team that really wasn't expected to do anything.
Now, Lionel, Peter Sagan's agent, Giovanni Lombardi, before Gent-Wevelgem even, which Sagan won last weekend, was apparently shopping his client, his star client, around teams that might be interested in signing him next year. We know that Tinkoff is probably closing at the end of the year. Silly April Fool jokes notwithstanding. I actually quite enjoyed their April Fool joke. But anyway, that's another story. Giovanni Lombardi has put a price tag on Peter Sagan's head of, I gather, around €6 million a season. Is he worth it?
Well, that would make him by far the most expensive asset in ever. Professional cycling ever, of course. I mean, even relative to, you know, taking into account sort of exchange rates and what have you, you know, that's putting him very, very high in sort of global sporting terms, really. I mean, obviously not touching American footballers, NBA players, and, you know, perhaps... you know, others who get huge endorsements, but in terms of just a salary for kitting up and getting on a bike, that is, you know, that's eye-watering money. And that really, whether he's worth it or not, is not really the point. It's whether anybody is going to pay up that sort of money to have Peter Sagan. It limits the number of teams that could even entertain that sort of figure to possibly, what, three?
Two. I mean, I think Etics, Quickstep, we talked about them lacking a finisher. Boonen's not going to probably do the whole season there. Next year he might do some of the season. They will have some extra money to spend, you would think. And whether they've got €6 million, I mean, as you say, it really depends on who is willing to pay that for Sagan. It might be that no one has that amount of money and he has to settle for 4.5, 5.
Yeah, I mean, this is settle for that. I mean, but this is beyond the realm of kind of like a bike company saying, we will finance this, this signing. This is seriously big money. And obviously, as once we get the big races out of the way, we're going to be looking at the future of professional cycling and the financing of it and the broadcasting of it and all of those other things, because we are on the cusp of a bit of a revolution, I think, in a lot of terms, including financially. And this could be, you know, as seismic a test case of a rider's value as anything that's happened since, you know, Greg LeMond and then Lance Armstrong.
I thought you were going to say he's a new Trevor Francis then. First £1 million player, first €6 million rider.
Yeah, and it will have a big knock-on effect. I mean, I think we've mentioned before on the podcast other riders sort of grumbling about the effect that Sagan's last contract had on the rest of the food chain, really. I think he is being paid by Oleg Tinkov about €4 million a year, and there was a feeling among other riders that skewed the market. There were certain deals that were done, for example, Nasser Buhani at Cofidis, and we mentioned Kwiatkowski last week. When he signed for Sky, Sagan's deal was mentioned, and you know, whether it's a good thing for the sport as a whole to have someone earning that amount of money, I don't know. Just on Sagan though, he really has finally made this breakthrough. The Italians have a nice phrase for it, salto di qualità, a jump of quality. He really has made it now, hasn't he? And he seems to have got over that problem. Well, we say this, he seems to have got over it in the last week or so, the problem he had of cramping or tiring in at the back end of big races. And yesterday he really had a lot more zip in his legs than anyone else towards the end.
Just on his value though, and how this all fits together, the thing that Peter Sagan has got is he has got star quality. He attracts eyeballs. He does things that are interesting, whether it's the wheelie after the finish line, you know, maybe some of the things he's done in the past, such as pinching a podium girl, you know, that was you know, negative publicity. I'm not condoning, you know, upping your market value by sort of dubious behavior, but in terms of the way cycling is structured, you know, you look at somebody like Chris Froome. You know, Chris Froome could win the next 4 Tours de France and still wouldn't really have that same magnetism and same kind of commercial value as Peter Sagan has now.
And Sagan's had very close associations with two major American bike manufacturers, Cannondale and Specialized. And in terms of showing to the general public what is possible on a road bike and making road cycling look fun, I don't think there's a better asset you could have than Peter Sagan.
Yeah, and I think talking off the bike as well, he's matured a great deal. He knows what is positive publicity. He knows how to get it. He knows how to manufacture it. And he knows how to link what he does on the bike to what he does off the bike. Yesterday's win being the perfect example. It was a real show by the greatest showman that I think we've got in cycling at the moment. I don't think there's any doubt at all that he's the biggest showman on the bike at the minute.
Pozzato's still riding. He's not retired yet. I know he finished 75th yesterday, but...
Well, he's not retired yet. I mean, what time does this podcast go? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But with Sagan, it's a good chance that yesterday is going to be one of the big highlights on the highlight reel of the Sagan Courier. It's the jewel in the crown of the Flemish classics, isn't it? It's a lot of people watching around the world will say, what's your favourite race? Tour of Flanders. It's going to be that, Roubaix, Tour de France, Giro, something like that, isn't it? Depending on what you're into. Sagan winning it in the World Champions jersey on the 100th edition, in the way that he won it, it was nothing short of a fairy tale, I thought. And that is going to make the Marca Sagan, to use another Italian expression, even more valuable. And his interview as well yesterday. You know, you went and won it on your own. Why did you win it on your own? Oh, I just thought it was better to drop everybody. Simple as that. And he's a superb, superb act on and off the bike.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
So that was our jingle for Eurosport. Just a little reminder of what's on Eurosport this week. The Tour of the Basque Country is running until Saturday. Richard's out there. We'll have a dispatch from him next week, I'm sure. And Paris-Roubaix on Sunday, the queen of the classics, the third of the monuments of the spring. Kicks off at 9:15, I think, on Sunday morning. Rob, you're going to be in the commentary box for a six-hour stint with Sean Kelly, twice winner of the race. Rob, I hope you've got, food and a bucket to answer the call of nature. Mm. I mean, I don't really know how it works in the commentary box.
Well, it's a funny one because Roubaix is quite unique. We're going to be in the stand in the velodrome. So most people at home sitting on the sofa with a nice warm cup of coffee in the morning. Join us at 9:15, very, very bright and early. I think it's going to be a 5 or 6 o'clock alarm call on a Sunday morning for Sean and I. You'll all be hoping, I think, that it's going to rain, won't you? You'll all want to see slippery cobbles, a horrible race for anybody on the bike, but an heroic one. We won't, because we're sitting in the stand, exposed to the elements. The papers will be flying all over the place. Oh, it's going to be a challenging broadcast. 7.5 hours, France Television, who are the host broadcasters, said they're going to produce. So, just spare a thought.
It sounds awful, doesn't it? It sounds like going down the mines.
Well, I didn't say we weren't looking forward to it, but it's going to be a unique challenge, let's say.
We're going there as well, aren't we, Daniel? We're pitching up in Roubaix on Sunday.
We're not going to complain about it at all. We're just getting on with it. Certainly not. Down.
Yeah, but I will be taking, an umbrella and a hat and a coat just in case. Should just mention our latest big race explainer produced in association with Eurosport as well, is on Paris-Roubaix. That's available in all the usual channels now. What I'm looking forward to about Paris-Roubaix and the fact that we will see the whole of the race is that it might bust a few myths about particularly the first 100 kilometres of the race that people assume is pan flat. It's actually across quite sort of rolling roads in northern France. It's a challenging old ride before they get to the first stretch of cobbles. I've done the full length sportive in the past, and that really caught me by surprise. I was expecting a lovely flat road all the way to the cobbles, but it was actually quite a grind. And if the wind's in the wrong direction, it can be pretty tiring before you even reach the main difficulties.
Yeah, you're a brave man to take that on, Lionel.
Well, I was a lot fitter back then. Although I'm approaching those levels of fitness now.
I was going to say, it wasn't easy, was it? No. In the Trainer Road Challenge. Results still embargoed for the minute, but I think you did yourself more than proud.
Anyway, Daniel, what are we looking forward to about Paris-Roubaix at the weekend?
We or I?
Well, you.
Well,
I mean, I don't expect you to speak for me, so yeah.
Well, Pozzardo's not riding next week.
Pozzardo's not riding. I'm looking forward to seeing how Etix Quickstep get themselves out of this fine mess, which we discussed earlier wasn't quite as much of a fine mess as perhaps some people are making out. A slightly different kind of rider can sometimes come to the fore, can't they, in Paris-Roubaix. I expect Nicky Terpstra, although he hasn't had a brilliant classics campaign to date, to go really well. He's more of a Roubaix type rider than a Flanders rider, and Sagan, up until now, although he has had a couple of good results in Paris-Roubaix, and he does have this history as a mountain biker and a fantastic bike handler, he's not quite as well suited. And part of the reason for that, Lionel, you mentioned it earlier, is his position on the bike is very, very upright, and aerodynamics actually play a part in Paris-Roubaix. You look at some of the very greatest Paris-Roubaix riders, I think you know what's coming, but Duclos Lassalle, very, very flat back, good position on the bike, Franco Ballerini, and of course, friend of the podcast, I like to think he's our best friend, Roger de Vlaeminck, Mr. Paris-Roubaix. We had a great Roger de Vlaeminck, another great Roger de Vlaeminck story, which didn't make the final cut for your Flanders special, did we?
It didn't. We'll have to give that an airing at some point. Perhaps if, you know, if...
Maybe we need Richard to introduce that.
I think we do, yeah. Let's stick to the present for now.
It involves cockfighting, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Yeah, slightly dubious. I'd like it to be double-sourced, really, the story, before we reference it. I think the thing about Paris-Roubaix as well is... looking at the types of riders, you immediately look at the top places of Tour of Flanders to identify who is going to be strong. Fabian Cancellara has staked a real claim for Sunday. But then, you know, the riders stacking up behind him, Sepp van Marck, Alexander Kristoff, who'd been ill but then looked pretty good in the 3 days of Dipana, didn't quite have it in the Tour of Flanders but is obviously coming up a bit. Luke Rowe, The big one for him is Paris-Roubaix, and I think you wouldn't necessarily have said he would finish as high as fifth in the Tour of Flanders. You would much expect him to be more suited to Paris-Roubaix. And then, of course, a little further down, Stibar and Terpstra for Etix Quickstep.
And Martin.
And Tony Martin.
Where's Tom Bonin fitting in all this? That's what I want to know. Because leading up to Flanders, I heard a few rumours from people in Belgium saying, well, Bone's much more realistic now. He thinks that Flanders is a little too hard for him. He might do a bit of work for the team towards the end, hoping for a bit of payback the week after. And it could well be Tom Bonin's final Paris-Roubaix. We still know that he hasn't got a contract for next year yet. And the rumours are that Patrick Lefebvre, as much of a fan and cheerleader he has been for him, is quite realistic now, saying, look, Tom, it's been a long time since you produced a top result. Is this the week that we're going to see a final big goodbye from Tom Bonin as well? It remains to be seen.
But the weather conditions, it's pointless speculating about how the race is going
to
play
pointless
out.
About, it's always pointless speculating about anything, isn't it?
The Lionel? Initial forecasts are for quite a rainy Sunday.
Well, if that is the case, it would be the first rainy Paris-Roubaix since...
For a long time.
A long time. I remember 2001 when Cervais Carnarvon won. That was very wet and muddy, and I remember being out on the cobbles and saw them on the first section looking fairly pristine still, and then we saw them about 25 kilometres later and they were just covered in a sort of cement grey paste from head to toe, just sort of, they'd all lifted their glasses up onto the tops of their helmets and you just sort of saw these sort of skin eye masks peering out of the grit.
It's interesting you mentioned Carnarvon's bike, because I was talking to a colleague in Belgium over the weekend and he was in Holland recently. That bike's in a museum. It's never been washed. The mud is still on it, all rusted away.
Degenkolb, same with Degenkolb from last year. Last year? Last year.
Yeah.
Last year.
It was. Seems a long time ago, doesn't it?
Short-term memory problems here. I mean, we all... It's funny, isn't it? And I don't want to kind of stray into debates about safety and what have you. But, you know, there is almost that sort of guilt at hoping for a wet Paris-Roubaix, because we know what that means. We know it means more danger for the riders, crashes, and it's you know, we've said it before in previous years, Paris-Roubaix, if cycling were founded today, Paris-Roubaix would not really exist, would it? I mean, it's such an anachronism. It's almost too extreme that and it's why probably there's only really a dozen specialists at any one time, plus a few, you know, that
And everyone accepts that, accepts those risks, accepts, you know, when it rains, and they accept that that's just part of the experience. And I think the key to that is this need there is now ever greater in professional cycling, in professional sport, for control. And the control, as far as Paris-Roubaix, comes from knowing exactly what they're up against, knowing that if it's going to rain, it's going to be awful. And, you know, what they don't like is sort of being ambushed by weather conditions or courses that they're not prepared for. But if it does rain, Lionel, I'm not going to speculate. I'm going to tell you who's going to win. It's going to be Lars Boom. Lars Boom, who is very much undecided about whether to continue his road career or whether to go back to cyclocross full time. And should he win Paris-Roubaix, that might tip the balance either way. He might decide that that's a good time to call it a day.
Of course, won the rainy, cobbly stage in the Tour de France a couple of years ago for Astana. Very impressive. Obviously, good. Well, it was about 100 kilometres shorter that day, wasn't it? It's a different completely different animal, Paris-Roubaix. They go over all of the hardest and most difficult cobbled sections. There's, you know, really is no mercy shown. But yeah, I think if we see a wet race, it will be one for the ages, as they always are, because they stick out. 2001 was pretty incredible. 1994, when André Schmiel won. I was talking to Luke Evans, the motorbike driver who carries Graham Watson, the photographer, and he was making the point about that day, none of the motorcyclists finished. It was such an extreme day.
André Schmiel, who was in Oudenaarde yesterday, is a former champion of the Tour of Flanders. There was this kind of procession, wasn't there, of all the champions to date, because it was the 100th edition. André Schmiel, who's also, I think, the scariest man I've ever interviewed, possibly the scariest man I've ever met.
Why do you say that?
Because I interviewed him once for half an hour and he did not make eye contact once. It was just me and him in a restaurant. Yeah, he looked at about 45 degrees for the entire time. He looked as though he was about to
constantly focused
pull out
on
a deadly
door.
Weapon at any point.
So what? Let's break with tradition. We did predict last week. We did run through some predictions. Daniel, you're going to go for Lars Boom.
I'm going to go Lars Boom with Sepp van Marck as my backup.
Okay, well, I'm going to go Alexander Kristoff with Luke Rowe as a backup. Rob?
And I find it really hard to see past Fabian Cancellara with the form he's on at the minute.
Well, we'll look forward to that then. And we'll discuss all of the big stories from Paris-Roubaix next week. Daniel, we're going to be there, so we'll capture some of the atmosphere in the velodrome.
We're going to have our mother hen back, aren't we, next week?
We are. Holding it together, perhaps a little more reliably than we've managed.
Our
I don't know.
And our Beckenbauer.
And he will be reporting back from the Tour of the Basque Country, where the Ardennes favourites and the Grand Tour contenders will be stretching their legs this week.
We should wrap it up. We should say thanks once again to our new sponsor, brand new sponsor, sigmasport.co.uk. Everything you need as far as road cycling is concerned, any equipment, any bikes, any sunglasses, what else do you use these days on a road bike? It's quite a long time since I sat on a road bike.
Well, you need everything, don't you, from head to toe. You need to be kitted out, you need to have all your bike in good working order, and yeah, Sigma Sport supply all of that stuff on their website.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.